Welcome to Libre Lounge, a podcast about free software, free culture, and all the other interesting aspects of user freedom, with Christopher Lemmer-Weber and Serge Roklowski.
All right, I'm Serge.
I'm Chris.
Welcome to the show. So this time, we thought we would talk about everyone's favorite topic, which is money. And specifically about how money impacts free software. And the big question is, how are you going to eat while you're developing free software? And how can we make free software sustainable when we don't discuss the financial aspects around it? And that's a big topic that people have been talking about since the very beginning of free software. And here we are, basically 40 years later, and we're still thinking about it. Well, maybe 30 years later, but we're still thinking about it. We're still discussing it. And it's still a big issue in a lot of people's minds. And so let's get down into the weeds here, Chris.
Yeah, it sounds good. So fundraising, so I've done a lot of jobs in my work on free software stuff. You know, I've done everything from, you know, coding to even some graphics and graphic design and management of, you know, a project, being a maintainer and doing documentation. And of all those roles, fundraising has been the hardest. And just as a little aside, I think not everybody realizes or appreciates that. I didn't always. I remember I used to work for a nonprofit that did some free software related stuff, and they hired somebody to do grant writing. And there were two people actually doing the grant writing. And I'm like, man, like, how hard can this be? Like, they're just like, you know, like that, how hard of a job could that be? We're doing all the serious work over here. And I am like ashamed to think of that state of my mind at this point, because I have never done anything harder than fundraising.
Yeah, fundraising is difficult. It's challenging. But let's take a step back and let's talk about free software and why free software needs or has a unique funding model. So when we think about proprietary software, we can kind of think about it pre-internet and post-internet. So pre-internet, you would buy your software. Most people would go to a store and just buy a box, and that box would contain disks or a CD-ROM, and that, you know, the purchase price would fund the developer, and that's, you know, that's it. And it was for the developer, it was a bit of an investment. Or so, you know, you'd put in all this work and you'd hope that people would buy the product. And if it worked out, great. And if it didn't, it didn't. But that's how investments go. Right. In the post-internet age, it's similar. People maybe they download it on either directly on someone's website, they have registration, or maybe they use a software distribution medium like an app store, or maybe they sell a subscription and they run it off a website. But let's focus, at least for this discussion, on software that runs on individuals' PCs. So, you know, you might buy a subscription and it'll come with all the updates or whatever. And with free software, we don't really have that same need, because the software is distributed freely. Of course, we always talk about the freedoms, but in this discussion, we can just focus on the price issue. And if you don't have to pay for it, how does the developer get the money that they need to live in the world?
Yeah. So it's a little bit complicated also because, you know, as you said, post-internet things have changed a bit. And I think actually pre-internet things were a bit closer for free software. The Free Software Foundation, I know I'm getting ahead of things a bit, but the Free Software Foundation used to be funded by selling software and manuals. And that's not the case now that we've moved to online distribution. You know, like, it's not quite as much of a moneymaker as it used to be, because most people were just getting things on tape. And so they were still basically buying it, even though they legally could copy and distribute it.
Right. That makes sense. Right. And now people don't really use, you know, containers. So software, what I mean by containers is disks or CDs or, you know, tapes, software tapes to distribute software. It's done over the internet. It's easier and it's faster for the most part. And you're right. So from a perspective of the average person, whether they were buying software that was proprietary, or buying software that was free as in freedom and allowed them to sort and read the source code and modify it, the process was much the same early on.
Right. But now, with the ability to copy everything and distribute it over a network, reduces the friction to such a degree that I think we kind of see both free software being, you know, in many ways, it's really great that you can copy it so easily. And that kind of is the foundation of, you know, our work. But also, and then you see on the other side, you see proprietary companies getting more and more strict about the fact that they're actually at risk, I say in quotes, from their, you know, kind of core mechanism of trying to push for money, which is that they're trying to make their thing a rivalrous good. So I want to talk about the difference between rivalrous and non-rivalrous goods.
Sounds good.
Yeah. So let's give some examples of rivalrous goods. So bread, right? Bread's a rivalrous good, because if I eat the bread, Serge, you don't get this bread anymore. And so that's a good example. But like, there's also, and most of the things that we operate with in the physical world are rivalrous in that kind of way. But when you say
rivalrous, really what you mean is that if I have it, you can't have it, and if you have it, I can't have it.
Exactly. And so when it comes to kind of digital distribution, when you want to have the illusion of rivalrousness, proprietary companies sometimes actually turn to either DRM or legal tools to kind of, you know, force people to do things. But we don't want to do that in free software, which leads us to a challenge that's called, we're building this commons of content. And that leads to two kind of classic thought problems, which are the tragedy of the commons and the free rider problem.
Are you also going to touch on the issue of marginal cost? Because I think that's a part of this discussion as well. Or do we want to get that now or no? Or
later? Why don't you explain that, and then okay, we'll get into the other ones.
All right. So when we think about the cost of producing a good, so you gave the example of a loaf of bread. So there's obviously a cost associated with that loaf of bread. There's the ingredients, there's the cost of having an oven, of the bakery itself, and the baker's time, and all of that. There's a cost associated with making that bread. If you make one loaf of bread, it's going to cost you a certain amount. If you make lots of loaves of bread, you can buy a bigger bakery, maybe even a factory, and the marginal cost, the cost of making each subsequent bread, will go down, right? So as you scale up, the cost of production goes down. That's the marginal cost. The thing about software is that it, for the most part, has a zero marginal cost. And what that means is that once a piece of software is developed and there is a version out there, it doesn't cost anything additional to make one or two or 1,000 copies. Right. It costs exactly the same. And that's why the software model for proprietary software is so strange, because you have to essentially create an investment as a developer. So proprietary software developers are putting in their work with the hopes that people will buy something that has zero marginal cost for non-zero amounts of money. And this is where I think you're going to go, which is that they have to then create artificial scarcity. Because in a natural market, an item that has zero marginal cost will cost nothing. So that means that the proprietary world has to create these artificial constraints to make the cost to the end consumer higher than zero.
Right. And it costs nothing once the thing exists. So actually, there's two kind of ideas that float around this. Actually, I think we can skip the tragedy of the commons, because we should have a whole episode maybe even on just like those philosophical concepts of game theory, tragedy of the commons, free rider problem and stuff. So I'm just going to jump straight to the free rider problem. So the free rider problem, the idea is that you've got, you know, so let's say you've got a bus. And you know, in most of our bus systems, you know, one person, each person pays for themselves to get on the bus. But you can imagine a bus system where one person just pays a big chunk of cash and then everybody else gets to ride for free. Well, who's going to be the first one to step up and pay for that ticket? Kind of everybody's incentivized to not do that. And that's not exactly true in free software that nobody's incentivized to do it. You know, people are very excited to be able to do work and stuff like that. But you do have this resource cost to be able to develop the thing initially. And you know, we haven't gotten into maintenance yet, but you know, if we just think about developing the software and ignore ongoing maintenance, you know, somebody pays for that upfront, and then everybody else can just take it and run effectively.
Right, and I think one of the things that I'm going to take a weird tangent here. So, free software as a community tends to attract two very different political spectrums. One being people who are, and I'm going to use the American political spectrum, people on the left and people on, so we'll say, you know, liberals and libertarians. And the reason that, and taking, I'm going to just put on the libertarian perspective here, is that they would talk about these as markets and in a natural market, where there were no artificial barriers, the incentive here is to wait for the initial cost and then to utilize and then basically to for everyone to just to take from that pool. I don't know if that made any sense. I got distracted, frankly. A little behind the scenes, my cats decided to both run in front of me while doing this episode. So got a little distracted in the middle of that.
It makes sense. So you described the libertarian perspective. I think you meant to describe the left perspective as well.
Yeah. Well, so the left perspective would be, thank you, would be the perspective of, well, once we have this good, everyone can benefit from it. So if we go back to this loaf of bread example that I gave, if we have a loaf of bread that can feed everyone, one magical loaf of bread that never depletes, it's in the best interest of all humanity that we make this loaf of bread and then everyone can eat from it forever.
Right.
So
there's another aspect. So actually, I do want to describe the tragedy of the commons also now that I think about it, because I think that the free rider problem tends to describe kind of the initial payment and then, you know, kind of running away. And the tragedy of the commons, the way that it might apply, is actually ongoing maintenance. The tragedy of the commons is you imagine there's, you know, this commons field where everybody can put out their sheep to graze, and everybody's only supposed to put out one sheep, but it's not really policed. And, you know, if your neighbor actually puts out two sheep, you lose out by not putting out two sheep yourself, it appears. But then, if you end up putting out two sheep as well, actually everybody starts doing that. Suddenly everybody's incentivized because somebody else is kind of cheating things to do that. And there's a problem with maintenance in the sense that, while the free rider problem, I think, really well describes non-rivalrous goods, the tragedy of the commons describes rivalrous goods pretty well, in that you have this resource that can be depleted, and that resource is kind of, in a certain sense, the energy to keep a thing running. And everybody's kind of incentivized from this kind of, you know, pure market type perspective to not contribute to that thing and kind of deplete it. So I don't know if we, you know, so that's kind of, there's more that can be said on
that's very
topics.
Heady. We got into a really heady place.
We got into a really heady start. I mean, that's good. You know, I like that kind of stuff. But let's now move into the actual stuff by, let's put a phrase directly at our users, which is, should you only pay if somebody puts a gun to your head? Sarah, so like you and I might both have an option to buy this fun you know, let's say there's a proprietary roguelike and a free roguelike, and both of them are very nice. And we both want to spend our weekend, you know, playing this game. And the proprietary roguelike, there's some legal, somebody does kind of put a gun to her head through the legal system in DRM. Does that seem accurate?
Yeah, through copy protection or DRM. Yeah, they're in some ways restricting our use of the software.
Right. But it doesn't seem to me in general in the free software case that it seems like I could just copy that and run away and not pay for it. So there's a question of when you are not forced to do it, should you do it? And I think you and I would both have a pretty simple answer to that, which is yes, correct?
That we should, I want to be clear on what I'm saying yes to. That you should what?
If you're presented with an opportunity to pay for the thing, you should give money, in theory.
I actually don't know if I would agree with that necessarily. And I actually don't think that, boys, we were not thinking this conversation would go in this direction, but I don't think that that's the way we need to be thinking about free software. So even someone like me who does give a lot of money to free software organizations and supports free software causes, the reasons that I support these organizations is not, you know, is because I want to support the author. So in that way, I guess the answer is yes. So you know, I always want to support the author, but I don't necessarily think that there's a moral obligation to pay for something that is given away freely.
Well, okay, so moral obligation is a tricky thing because defining moral obligation is kind of complicated. But so maybe not an imperative, but there is kind of a moral drive in a sense to give because you do feel like there's an ethical purpose
right. Well,
to giving.
Right, there's reciprocation, right? So if someone is giving me something of value to me, right, and that could be software, you know, in our example, you're roguelike, right? So I'm going to enjoy this roguelike. I feel that I should give something back to them, especially if I want to support the creator or creators of this game and want to support them enjoying their life and also want to support more work from them in the future. So then the answer is yes.
Right. So I also want to throw out there that it seems to me that a lot of people, so I'm not endorsing Steam as a DRM distribution of games platform. But one thing that strikes me is that I know a lot of people who are more than capable of, you know, I'm putting air quotes around this, but pirating, a proprietary game off of there, and yet choose to, even though they're doing a proprietary game, choose to, actually, you know, pay for it in that way. And that strikes me partly that, even in the proprietary case, there might not actually be a gun requirement, you know, that artificial gun that we're introducing, that people may be incentivized to do it because they do actually want to be able to support the underlying structure that allows this thing to exist.
Right. And we can look at, I don't want to look too closely at proprietary organizational structures. I think we should spend the most of our time talking about free software organizational structures, but the example that comes to mind in as a counter to Steam would be Humble Bundle. So in Humble Bundle, you can also buy proprietary software.
Originally free software, actually, and then they switched away from that.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Okay. And you could pay what you wanted, and you can still do that, I believe, at least to some extent. And they also, as far as I know, don't have any DRM in software that is distributed via Humble Bundle.
Right. And so mm-hmm. Yeah, to make it clear, I'm not actually bringing these things up to endorse these things. I do not endorse Steam. I don't endorse buying proprietary games. But I do think that it's interesting for us to examine the underlying incentive structures of these things in general. And even looking at the proprietary case kind of, I think, exposes that. The belief that we should only pay for things when there's a gun to our heads, that, you know, people might be able to dodge that gun pretty easily and do it anyway.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what you're talking about is what motivates people and why are they paying for something that they could, in theory, not pay for? And this is a question that many proprietary software and culture creators and distributors think about. right? It's the, why do I pay for music when I could just pirate it? Or why do I, you know, why should someone pay for a streaming service when they could download it off? They could download the video off the internet. Some of that they've taken from us in term, but I don't want to get too deep into that. Meaning, so there's things that we've created like package managers and directories of software that are very similar to App Store type experiences, but we can learn from our proprietary brethren what they're, you know, what we can use their experience to further our needs and our means to getting better free software structures that will be sustainable in the long term. Do we want to just jump into what the various structures that are currently funding free software are?
Sure. Why don't we do that? And then let's get into kind of a little bit more of the meta of the funding stuff right at the end.
Okay. Good. Cause I think we've gotten way too far into the wonky bits. So when I think about free software models, when I say models, I mean, how the heck do people who are programmers get paid to program? And in some cases they don't, right? So in some cases a programmer has another job. They work at their job and then in their spare time they work on free software. And that could also apply to a student, for example, who they're studying, they're not getting paid for developing, they're not getting paid at all, or they've got a second job and then they work on free software in their off time.
And that's actually it's important because we actually have a reciprocal gift economy of sorts people are giving back, not just because necessarily money's in the way, but they might be like, oh, I really benefited from this, so I want to give back in the way that I can, which can be code or something like that.
Well, and I think there's another part, there's another part that's really important here, which is the motivator for these people may be the desire to give back. It could also just be that they believe this is the right thing to do, that their motivation is purely a moral motivation. It's part of our ethics and our culture of giving back. So maybe they've used free software before and their motivation is, wow, I really have benefited from the community and not just I want to give back directly, but giving is good. And also, I think something that has gotten lost in our culture is that it feels good to give.
Yeah.
It feels good to do things for others. And that is an important motivation.
Yeah.
It's actually one that if anyone of our listeners listens to Free as in Freedom, Free as in Freedom's last episode in 2018, their only episode in 2018, Karen Sandler mentions, the moral feelings and these ethics as a motivator for sustainability and free software.
Yeah.
So that's one really basic model. I think the rest of it that we're going to discuss are models by which developers get paid for working on free software in some way.
And something you brought up, do we want to discuss this now? I think we should, because I think you started to discuss, you know, that a lot of people don't get paid. And before we actually discuss the funding models, which we should get to because haven't yet. I think that, you know, you were talking to me about this before the show, is that, you know, introducing money can kind of change a community. Isn't that right?
Yeah. I mean, so when we think about, there's a term in psychology of cognitive dissonance. And when your morals don't meet your actions, when they're out of sync, it's your morals that change. And when we create artificial incentives to do good behavior, people motivate themselves or they align themselves with the reward rather than intrinsic motivation. So you see this, for example, they've done studies with kids, and I wish I had one off the top of my head, but I don't, where you take children and you say, it's good to put away your toys. It's good to do chores. It helps your family. We're all in this together. And then if you introduce financial rewards, so if you do the dishes, I'll give you $1. Then over time, children are demotivated to do chores unless they're getting paid.
Right. Yeah. And once you end up starting to get paid, in something that's like a community like free software, you might also end up getting into conflict about, okay, now we have money, who gets it? And, you know, once you introduce that, you might not have had, there was no debate about who got it before, but now if there's five developers and there's enough to maybe pay one full time or spread it out, you might end up actually having disagreement about who should get it.
Right. And in addition to that, you add overhead in terms of making sure that people are getting paid, that, and as you say, we create conflict. You know, conflict can arise in, oh, I worked 5 hours, but you know, you only worked 3 hours, but you might say, well, but my 3 hours are more important than your 5 hours, you know, and those kind of conflicts arise, as you say, but you also have to have someone taking in the money. You have to have someone doing accounting, and you have to have someone sending out the checks. There's all kinds of complexity, both practical and emotional, that come in once you introduce these external motivators.
Yeah. But I mean, I think, okay, despite those complications, I think you and I still believe that most free software is dramatically underfunded and that leads to problems.
Yeah. And so two examples that we were discussing before the show that were, I think, motivators for us doing this show were vulnerabilities in NTP and in OpenSSL. And so NTP is the network time protocol. It's the thing that keeps the computers on the internet in sync, which is a very important basic function that computers on the internet need. They need to be in sync for a whole bunch of stuff to work. So they use this protocol called NTP, and NTP has an implementation on Unix that's pretty much the same everywhere. And there was a vulnerability, and the problem is that NTP was underfunded and the developer just couldn't keep up with the demand. And even though this was such a fundamental piece of software that gets run on millions or billions of computers, it wasn't maintained properly because it didn't have the developer didn't have the resources to dedicate to it. It didn't have either their own time or perhaps a team of people that could keep up with it. And similarly, OpenSSL, which is a piece of a library that's used in encryption, so sort of the basic building block of browser communication and in addition to other things, SSH, et cetera, also had vulnerabilities, but again, didn't have the developer resources because it wasn't funded properly. So not having free software funded sufficiently can cause major headaches.
Right. And what you discussed right there are both kind of, I'd consider, very infrastructure-y type things that also in some ways does appeal to what we kind of call the open source development methodology type approach that many businesses have, that kind of, you know, took the world by storm starting around, you know, in the late 90s and the early 2000s, of like, oh, well, we can, you know, we should pay for these, you know, this commons of libraries where we'd have, but, you know, and other tooling infrastructure, but that kind of last layer we're going to proprietize. And then there's also, I think, a category of things that are also difficult to fund. You might be able to, and we'll talk about kind of, you know, getting those organizations to get motivated to fund those types of things. But there's also categories of things which, you know, don't really, that are kind of much more end user facing, like, you know, LibreOffice or Blender or things like that, that are not kind of, you know, are frequently not kind of that are kind of hitting the end user, but are not necessarily at some company's infrastructure stack.
Right. So when we talk about NTP and OpenSSL, they're vitally important pieces of software, but the average person on the street isn't going to know what they are. But if you say to someone on the street, have you ever heard of Firefox? they're probably going to say yes. If you ask them, have you ever heard of LibreOffice? Maybe they've heard of LibreOffice or OpenOffice. They're likely to say that they have. And we have a number of pieces of free software that are popular enough at this point that the average person on the street has heard of them and has probably used them.
Yep. Okay, so let's get to the actual funding categories.
Organizational models. Yeah. I think we should talk about them as organizational models.
And we've kind of split these up into two very, very overlapping categories. And I'm going to put both of these in scare quotes again. So charity funding, and I hear my scare quotes around my fingers, and then businessy funding, also in scare quotes. And like, these are very, very, do not think of these as strict categories. We're just kind of, I think they're kind of a very broad category, very broad umbrellas that tend to overlap in this way.
Yeah. So before we jump into that, just explaining these categories and why we're naming them this way, when we started thinking about this and we started planning this episode, we initially used the U.S. centric terms of nonprofit and for profit, and these terms, they're terms of art relating to tax designation, and they're basically regarding how you as an organization create your tax, basically file your taxes and what your mission is. But in reality, and by the way, the term charity is that same term of art in the United Kingdom. Their term for nonprofit is charity. But the problem is that discussing tax structure doesn't entirely capture the nuance of, for example, there are nonprofits that are structured as nonprofits, but have employees and do grow. And they look to anyone who's not a tax official, like just a regular business. They would look just like a regular business. And there are for-profit companies that have a more humanitarian bend to them, that are more focused on social issues, even though they are for-profit. So we've decided that issue of tax designation isn't really where we want to draw our line, but it's a good starting place. And we can think of these things as on a polarity, right? So you have humanitarian charities on one end and completely profit-oriented businesses on the other. And we can see that there's some kind of spectrum, especially as it relates to the kind of organizations that we're talking about, many of which are small, sustainable businesses that are not focused on rapid growth on one end, and 501c3 tax designated charities, nonprofits on the other end that maybe don't even have any employees. So we can think of them as a spectrum, but not using tax as our not using tax designation as our a delineator, but rather just the motivations of those involved and the structures that they've created to fund themselves based on those motivations.
Yeah, I think that's a great summary. So speaking of that, since we are using it kind of as our base, and you mentioned 501c3 charities, I think when a lot of or nonprofits, I think a lot of us in the U.S. at least, and I think probably globally, when we think about how nonprofits make their money, especially at this time of year, where right now, I know in the U.S. at least, there's kind of a people, because there is a tax incentive, a bunch of people end up, you know, doing a whole bunch of donations right at the end of the year. But I think that also, in general, we have this kind of impression of kind of the charity side, being very donation driven, and there's kind of a spectrum of donations, like kind of donation drives that end up happening, I think.
Yeah. As a 50, you know, as a tax, so as a nonprofit, you are restricted in how you, bring in income. And in the U.S., it is fairly strict about how you can sell or not sell your, goods or services as a nonprofit. So most nonprofits rely on donations where that's not an issue.
Right. So one, you know, so one type of donation that you could do is just go to a, you know, a nonprofit that you like or any project that you like, actually. And many of them actually have just a you know, some sort of donation link. And you could just click that, throw in some money, and do a one-time donation. So that's a classic method. I guess the other approach is kind of the annual supporter drive, which is a little bit more what I think we're talking about right here. Many nonprofits tend to actually really pull in much of their donations from an annual supporter system because it's actually recurring donations where you get kind of the bulk of your support. And so if you've got a very nonprofit-y home that's housing your software, it may be that annual donations may be a place where that funding is coming in.
Yeah, recurring donations, whether they're annual or they're often nowadays are more often monthly, are hugely important for nonprofits. Monthly, especially though, because they allow a nonprofit to get an idea of what their cash flow will look like going month to month, right? The issue, and I know it's a little bit wonky in terms of discussing the revenue models of these organizations. If you're running a nonprofit, it's good to know that you will get X amount in July and X amount in October, rather than just getting a ton of money at one time of the year and then having to try to spread that out. It's more useful to know that those monies are recurring. So yeah, recurring donations are hugely popular in the nonprofit world.
And actually, increasingly, not mm-hmm. just in the 501c3. Okay,
yeah, you had it. I always mix those up.
I transpose things a lot. So it's kind of funny because we're actually seeing that in not just a nonprofit sense increasing, and not just in free software. But I think it's good that we are seeing it in free software, and I'd like to see more of it in free software. Is like, you know, it partly because Patreon and other organizations like it, like LiberaPay, have made it easier for people to kind of set up these monthly donation type systems.
Yeah, the Patreon model, it's funny in a lot of ways. We're going back to the very old, some of these old structures and old ideas of a patron, which is, you know, just basically a very wealthy person who's giving money to a charitable cause. Frankly, because in those times, it was seen as a societal duty of the aristocrat and the you know, the king or the duke to give to the system. That was part of their requirement. It was seen as the circle of life, right? I could also geek out on that, so I'm not going to. The other way you can think about it is I think about it like the monk model, and I'm thinking about, you know, Buddhist monks or churches where their congregation gives money to sustain these people who are sustaining them in a spiritual sense. But in this way, you know, we're doing it in the Patreon, which doesn't just support free software. We're giving it because we support this as we support our creators. We want to keep their community. We want to have a community feeling, but also we just want to sustain them. They give to us and we give to them. So I think that in a lot of ways, they're facilitating these very old ideas and bringing them back into our consciousness.
Yeah. And I think it's very inspiring to see that, like, many of the web comics I read are, you know, artists are being finally, you know, pretty well funded off of recurring donations. And I know there's been some criticism that, oh, this is kind of, you know, like, this is kind of knocking it off of the, you know, 501c3, you know, approach. But in many ways, I think, you know, it, not everybody has the infrastructure to kind of set up for that type of thing. So I think making it easier to have payment mechanisms and have recurring payment things to connect to donors, I think it's good to kind of make that easier to access. So I'd love it if we had less centralized platforms to do it.
Yeah, but that's not the only model. There are other models, and we should and I don't know if we even want to start breaking this episode down into two parts, frankly, because we're at 40 minutes in here.
Yep. Yeah, we could do two episodes.
So we might want to split this up and do two parts. So maybe we'll do that heady discussion-y stuff here, and then next time discuss the organizations and with some practical examples.
Well, why don't we just finish the charity stuff, and then we'll do the businessy stuff on the next episode.
That sounds great.
Okay, so the next one, actually kind of tying in with, you know, another non-profit-y, you know, actually a very commons-oriented original type thing that actually a for-profit has kind of swept into the space. The ransomware approach, or the Kickstarter-ish approach, I guess is how people see it now, crowdfunding, was actually really huge a few years ago, and is not as huge as it was, but it's still pretty large. And it's kind of funny because the first crowdfunding system I know of that got pretty big, the first was actually a free software project. It was Blender. In the early 2000s, the company Not a Number that was making Blender was going out of business. Their investors were upset, and Ton Ruzendahl was like, "Hey, I can raise some money so that you can get some of your money back. And if we raise that much money, can we release this as free software?" And they said yes. And in a very short period of time, people raised the money, and the community kind of bought the rights to have Blender be free software. And that was the origin story of Blender. And in many ways, that kind of so there's kind of this idea of ransomware, which is, you know, I have this thing, you'd like this thing, give me enough money, and then it becomes, you know, we release it. And that was ransomware was originally kind of developed as a vision to how to be able to fund commonsy projects, if I remember correctly. But then Kickstarter also kind of took it into crowdfunding in general as almost more of a store in some ways, even though they say, well, Kickstarter is not a store. In many ways, it's kind of become a way to fund products and maybe things that don't exist yet fully.
And I think one of the key things that Kickstarter had to do as a business was let's flip this around. For crowdfunding Blender didn't just come out of nowhere and people started saying, "Oh, we want to make some 3D software and we have no qualifications. You've never heard of us. Give us money." Right. So the people involved in the creation of Blender had had something to show for their work. So this was a transitional type project. In terms of we were working on this, we want to continue to work on this, and we're taking it to the next step. What Kickstarter had to do was, since you couldn't vet everyone, they had to create these other artificial incentives. But I think that the important thing here is that the reputation was a component in the creation of Blender. So the people that were creating Blender were people that we knew about. It wasn't just, you know, someone that you'd never heard of saying, I've got this ambitious idea, but no idea how to implement it.
Yeah. And I mean, so I've done two of these crowdfunding campaign type things, both of them through the Free Software Foundation when I was working on Media Goblin full time. And that, you know, paid for my work, and then it paid for Jessica Talon's work. And actually, really, in a certain sense, it paid for the ability for me to work on ActivityPub. For, you know, ActivityPub, the Federation standard, wouldn't have happened unless if I had been able to get this space by being able to pay Jessica Talon to maintain and develop the Federation code for Media Goblin so that we could standardize that. And it was hard running those crowdfunding campaigns. It's really, and in many ways, those things are very similar to the annual supporter drive type approach, but without actually being annual. The mental anguish about, you know, setting everything up. You have no idea if it's going to succeed. You make this video, you do all that stuff. It is, you know, definitely one of the hardest things I've done in my life.
Which is why there's a whole industry now around helping companies and individuals create crowdfunding campaigns. There's a whole industry of people saying, we will help you with your crowdfunding campaign, because they know just how difficult it is.
Yeah. I mean, I was, my spouse Morgan and I worked together, and, you know, Morgan did a lot of the work, but, we worked together, and I mean, spent time, you know, packaging things and, you know, sitting in the postal office and all that stuff to get that stuff out. And I totally understand why there are people who, you know, go with other businesses to do that. But anyway, the main point of this thing is that the crowdfunding type approach, either falls into one of two categories. It's either I have a thing and it can be free, from the free software's perspective, it can be free if only you all give me this much money. And that's the ransomware approach. And the other approach is, I haven't built this thing yet, but I have enough reputation where if you give me enough money, we can make this happen. And those are kind of the two sides of the crowdfunding perspective, I'd say.
Yeah. And I mean, there's some middle ground that it's not as common, right, where someone might say, well, I've got this piece of software that does this, but I want to take it to the next level. Or maybe it's not super easy to use and I want to add a front end or whatever. Right. But I think a lot of free software ones hit that middle ground.
I think
we can just see those as polarities rather than, you know, they're not binary. These two things, software is going to be on some kind of, everything's here is going to be on some kind of spectrum. So yeah, I agree with your distinctions.
Yeah. So then there's the other one, which is that you're going to go download something from a website. And because you're downloading it from the website, there's a button next to download that says, you know, please donate, or might even encourage you to click through the donation before you get to the download. And actually that starts to move into the businessy kind of side of things in some cases. In some cases it doesn't. It's kind of confusing to me sometimes. But you know, what's funny, I think, is that, the document found, the Document Foundation, they do this for the download page, I believe, for Windows downloads, right?
Sorry, so the Document Foundation is the organization, I was going to say company, they're the organization that is in charge of LibreOffice,
right?
A free software office suite.
Yeah, and so if I go and I click download on there, I get, you know, there is a button that can encourage me to donate, and I might do so. The Document Foundation does this a little bit more indirectly. I think we'll talk about Ardour and some other organizations that do it much more directly, as if you're buying it. But, you know, in this case, I'd say we're kind of doing the suggested donation model. And what's funny is that I think that most of the Document Foundation's funding and other organizations that do this type of thing, their money mostly comes from Windows users. And that's because Windows users do go to the website to download things. Maybe that's less true now that Microsoft has their new app store. But I think that that's historically been the case.
It might be. I mean, the other, we could of course ask if, we could look at, for example, Ubuntu. Ubuntu also has a download, page that comes up when you want to download the software. So, that you know, it might be a fun exercise if someone could look at the percentage of individuals who donate to each of those things. I don't know. I don't remember if Firefox also has a donation page come up when you try to download it.
Yeah, but what's kind of funny is that I do know from having talked to a few projects about this that they say that most of their donations do not come from that style of donation where you click on the download button donation. It's not that donations in general from free software operating system users don't happen. It's just that, in general, I think it tends to come from, there is a free software package managers make it so that you never kind of see that button in a certain sense.
Right. It's so for people who aren't users of GNU Linux, it's if you can imagine an app store where everything is free, that's basically our experience of the world for the most part. Is if you want to program, you just say, oh, I want this, and suddenly it's on your computer.
Right. So I mean, that so FDroid does do this. They have donate buttons next to the different things. Admittedly, I don't use them because I don't have an easy way to donate on my phone very easily that I trust. But I sometimes do wish that I had an easier way from my package manager to be incentivized and to choose how to be able to donate. Like, oh yeah, I'm really using this a lot. I should give some money. I don't know. Do you feel that way? Do you think that that would make a difference?
Yeah, I actually, at one point, years and years ago, tried to create this.
Oh, really?
Where I had a script that would, so I want to go back one thing you said, which is F-Droid. And for people that don't know, F-Droid is basically the free software, Android marketplace for Android phones that, So it's basically an alternative marketplace where everything is free software. So anyway, so the years ago on GNU Linux, I tried to write a software. It would basically ran PS, which is a command that lets you see all the programs that are running. And I thought, well, like, oh, okay, well, what I'll do is I'll look at all the programs that are running. And from there, I can determine what package what package each program is from, and then I'll have some kind of receipt or something that will report that'll tell me, like, oh, you're using this a lot or using that a lot. And it turned out, of course, that I was using like libc all the time.
Right.
So that didn't quite work out. It also ended up being that, you know, Firefox was running all the time and Emacs was running all the time and terminals were running all the time.
Oh yeah.
And so give all that money to Xterm. Right. Yeah. It was just like, okay, this doesn't really accurately reflect my usage. But I think it was an interesting problem. And I think it's one that we as free software users, don't have a good idea of, which is, How much value add to our lives does this software provide? We don't want to think about the money, and we shouldn't have to think about the money. That's actually an important thing that I want to emphasize here, is that we don't say, oh, you must pay us back. There's no direct obligation, but for those of us who can, it would be nice to be able to say, hey, you know, this program that I use has really helped me out in some way. I should really think about it. So an example that's coming to mind is, I write a lot of software in Python. It might be good that I haven't donated to the Python Foundation in a while. And it might be nice if something said, hey, I see you've been writing a lot of software in Python. Have you considered donating to Python? Or, hey, I see you using Django to write websites. Maybe you should give money to the Django Foundation, right? Or something like that.
Right. And another thing that – another observation that's been made many times is that the modern app store that's, you know, a proprietary app store looks a lot like package managers that we've had in free software for a long time, right?
Yeah, I said that earlier.
Yeah. So, but one of the funny things is that, and actually I know quite a few free software projects where they're really excited to get on one of these proprietary app stores because then they start getting money from that source. And it kind of bugs me that, free software people do want to give money. And like, I think a lot of people do want to give money, like, don't want to only say that they, if you ask them, should you only pay with a gun to your head, they'd say no. And yet, clearly, our package managers are not delivering on this, you know, on this thing that I think many users would voluntarily do if given the option. And I don't know how to improve that situation, actually.
Yeah, I don't think there is a great solution right now to that. We are both terrible at staying focused. So,
well, this is good conversation though, at least.
No, it is great. And I hope, I hope people like it.
Give us feedback.
So let's talk about the charity. So are we still, we've talked about, LibreOffice. As an example charity.
Yeah. So this is kind of the donation. I think we kind of wrapped up the kind of what I would consider different donation things, right? One-time donations, annual supporter style, or these kind of crowdfunding style donations, and the like donate when you click forward a lot right on a website, right? All of those strike me as donation-y things.
What about grants? Are we going to talk about that here?
Right. Or
are we
gonna let's talk about grants. Next episode? Let's talk about it. No, I think that grants are great because grants are kind of like donations, but they usually come from one major source. Usually not an individual, though sometimes it may be. But usually grants come from some sort of, other, it's kind of, you know, one charity supporting another group's work in general. Is that, would you say, consider that accurate, or how would you summarize it?
Yeah, I would, but I would say that the one thing that makes grants interesting is that in some ways they remind me a bit of, crowdfunding, in that they're most grants, although not all, but most grants have a whole bunch of strings attached, right? They're going to say, well, we want to see you producing some outcome. We might even have metrics by which we want to measure your success.
Right.
And if we don't see you meeting certain milestones, we're not going to keep giving you money.
Right. And that varies, right? Some grants are much more loose about how they give money, and some of them do have more of these strings, as you said. And you know, all of those can be valid, depending on, what's applicable. And the way you get grants can really vary. But usually I think most grants, there's some sort of grant submission process where a bunch of people kind of throw in proposals and some committee looks over the proposals and somebody wins. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, I would say that's about right. Yeah, it's almost a bidding process in a way.
Yeah, kind of a bidding, but bidding with an output that's supposed to be in the public good, though.
Yeah, that's right. So we want to talk about maybe corporate sponsorships.
Yeah,
as a corporate sponsorships to charity organizations as a model.
Yeah, I mean, so in. It's kind of similar to grants. How would you distinguish these things?
I mean, I think that's the interesting part, is that they're all on a spectrum, right? So some corporate sponsorship is basically a donation, right? They just want to give money. They have some, maybe they have some tax reason to do so, and they just make a check out to some nonprofit and say, here it is. Sometimes they'll say, we'll write you a big check, but we want acknowledgement, we want credit for writing you this big check. So put us in your newsletter or mention us on your website. And then I feel like it can go up from there. The obligations to the nonprofit can increase from there.
And would you consider and it's actually, I think it's much more rare than people get it advertised to, but there's the mythical kind of 20% time, like you do free software and a portion of time at your work. And it doesn't happen as often as I think people get the impression, but it does happen sometimes. And that it can be really exciting to people when those types of opportunities come up. Would you consider that sponsorship, where if an employer says, you know, we really like this project, we're willing to let our employees do a certain amount of work? Or do you think that's a different category?
I think that's a different category. I think that's part of the business models that I think we had planned on talking about.
Okay.
But since we're so late into the episode,
let's skip ahead on that. Yeah. So this is a different corporate approach thing where it's giving to a charity. It's not using your internal resources.
Yeah. Although, and I guess the big issue that these types of donations from charities, right? Sorry, these sponsorships bring up is, are there strings attached? And I think that there are almost always some strings attached. By the way, with any donation, right? There's an implicit string attached. So, if I give to an organization, I want to think about a non free software example. So, if I give to an environmental cause for example, and I find out that environmental cause has been dumping toxic waste, I'm not going to give to them anymore. There's the strings attached to my donation are that they have to be effective and do what they say they're going to do in terms of designation. You know, we're an environmental charity, so we're going to do environmental work. The kind of strings attached that a corporate donor might have is that, you know, if you're, for example, a publication, a newspaper, something like that, they might not want you writing about them.
Right.
Or writing something negative about them. And in free software, I'm not sure what those look like. In terms of, you know, when those strings are pulled, but I'm sure that those kind of issues can come up.
Though I do think that there are times where we have seen this, where some companies that really rely on free software do decide, we should try to give back and we should be pretty loose about what it is. It may be mostly that their name is attached to it in some way. So, and I've been a beneficiary of this. So I got to participate in the Stripe open source retreat. Stripe, you know, which is an organization that, you know, I think they did something good by, you know, they paid me to, you know, work on site on the things that I was working on. That's another way that ActivityPub was funded, actually, was, you know, I was working on Media Goblin and ActivityPub from their office, and they were like, you know, no strings attached. You know, the only real string that was there was that they got their name out there. And, you know, you might say, well, Stripe has a non-free JavaScript, you know, problem in their client that I agree. I would actually like to see that changed. I would like to see a free software JavaScript interface for their payment stuff, the default payment thing. But, you know, is it still a good idea for them to run that kind of program? And I personally feel like I think that, you know, they're, given how easy it is to take from the commons without giving back, and how rare it can be for companies to give back, I think it's great when a company does decide to step up and do some sort of sponsorship. And I think we should encourage it.
Yeah, just as a funny aside, I don't know if you know that the Collison brothers who founded Stripe are Lispers.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
They've talked about that in their... and there, how the company was founded. I think some of the initial code was written in Lisp. But getting back to the question of corporate strings on donations, I think it doesn't come up very often, but it may when an organization has a nonprofit or a foundation associated with it, and they have membership that, you know, basically sponsor membership, where by paying a certain amount, you have a seat at the table,
right?
And you may have more influence.
So this, we may say this is especially happens in 501c6 scenarios, right? Which, if you listen to Free Innocent Freedom, you've probably heard plenty of stuff about the difference between 501c3s and 501c6s.
Yeah, the trade associations, I believe.
Yeah, and I don't know if we really want to go into that here.
No, I don't think. I think that people that want that can listen to Free and Freedom, and they should listen to both of us, but for those type of really deep legal dives, they should definitely listen to Faith.
Yeah, sounds good. All right. So,
but yeah, so let's keep going. Is there any more charity?
So this is kind of in the sponsorship category, but we have two programs that happen. One of them has one very direct sponsor, and the other one actually has a number of different sources of funding. But I think it's interesting because they are a way to fund stuff and projects, and quite a few projects. Both Google Summer of Code and Outreachy are funding, usually for newcomers and students, sometimes people who have been, you know, pretty long established in the community. But since it's aimed at students primarily, I think Outreachy is more loose and doesn't have just a student requirement, but usually both of those things are ways to get people into your community and to encourage new contributors. And they do give a stipend for people to work on code. And many features do come into free software projects because of those programs.
Yeah, I was a Google Summer of Code mentor two different years. And so basically they work somewhat differently in that Google Summer of Code students are paid through Google, and an outreachy, it's a little bit more complicated, where it's essentially they're almost like a matchmaker finding students and attaching them with fundraisers and with projects.
Right. So
it's a little bit more complicated. That relationship's a little more complex. But yeah, essentially from a student perspective, they're doing the same. And from a free software perspective, students are getting paid. I'm just going to say students, even though that may not be totally accurate. Students are getting paid to be free software contributors and to get a taste of what it's like to work in the free software community.
Yep. And so I think that's a good summary. There's a lot more that can be said about both projects. And I think we've talked about Outreachy on episode 3. If you want to go back and hear a bit more about that.
And episode 5.
Oh, yeah. And I'm sure we'll have plenty more to say in the future. We'll probably even get on some outreachy organization people. But let's keep going on this. So we've got a couple more slots, just two more slots that we wanted to talk about on charity. And then we should wrap this one up. So the next one is government funding. And I know you've got lots of thoughts on this, Serge. So why don't you take it away?
Yeah, I almost think that government funding should be part of the next one. But I'll tease everyone a little bit.
Okay.
My view on a lot of software is that the software that we have is infrastructure. It is the base that our society runs on at this point. If you use government websites, if you do almost anything on the internet, or even sometimes off the internet, you are encountering free software. Having good quality, bug-free, maintained free software is vital to our functioning society. And that's true whether you live in, the United States, Canada, whether you live in Europe, South America, Africa, anywhere you live, Asia, it doesn't matter where you live, free software is part of your life. And the government, governments fund projects like roads, and they fund projects, like food safety inspections and health trials and other things that are to the benefit of all. And I have worked in the past at government-run research institutions. I worked as a contractor. I worked both at NASA and at NIH. And the U.S. government funds those organizations, and the work that they create is put into the public domain. And I think that the work that free software does is just as important, and maybe even more important, on a day-to-day basis. And I believe that free software should be funded directly by governments in order to keep things running. It is in the collective best interest of everyone that we fund free software. And of course, this can get complicated about, well, then who's going to fund it? Should it be the United States? Should it be France? Should it be Chile? That's a different problem, but let's at least start talking about this as a political issue, where if I go to a politician and I say, well, I want my tax money going to this because it's important to the world. And in the same way that I believe that I want to see more of my tax money going to research, and I want to see more of my tax money going to science, I want to see more of my tax money going to free software.
Right. And we should also say that historically, your tax dollars have funded a lot of proprietary software. If the public is paying for it, I feel like the public should benefit for it. Like, that is a straight up common scenario. And I think you'd probably agree.
Yeah, and as you say, the government does buy, you know, does procurement of software, and there have been programs that have preferred free software over time. In Europe, in the United States, I don't know. I don't have specifics on that right now. The big news is that the EU has put out a bug bounty for free software. And bug bounty is basically that they're going to help, they're going to put money toward the addressing of certain bugs that are in free software. And there's a whole bunch of them, and they're different projects. And that's great. And I'm really excited to see that. And I think that's a great start. But I think we need to go further. I think instead of saying, okay, the government's going to fund specific bugs, that the government should have an office that, and I say the government, I mean all the governments should have an office that that is maintaining, or that is funding the maintenance of software, whether that's through employing people to write free software, or whether that is, you know, doing through kind of contracting or through donations. I think those are open questions about what the fiscal structure looks like. But I think it's vitally important for society that we have these kind of structures. This is something that I've thought about a lot over the last decade, and has become increasingly important as time has gone on.
Yeah. And I mean, we can and should. I think you and I both know some people who are involved in you know, government funded free software stuff, and we should get them on here. But it's also worth saying that there were a couple of executive orders that Obama signed during his administration that directly encouraged the release of, you know, federally funded stuff as being free software, and also, you know, open data, I'll say also around in quotes. And I don't know if those got overturned. I can't find the pages they used to be at anymore, like a lot of things that have happened since the recent administrative turnover. But that was an initiative that was started a few years ago, and I'd like to see more of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that those grand initiatives are great. I know that having, you know, been in these environments, those decisions, although influenced by those kind of orders, are often done at a much more individual project, individual contract level. That are, of course, influenced by policy. But I think that rather than do these gestures of we would prefer if software were free, that the government can just say, here's a new initiative. And that initiative is that we are going to set aside money specifically for this purpose.
Yeah, I agree.
I think that's where we need to go.
I agree with that.
So do we want to talk about academia, or do we want to leave that for the next show?
I mean, academia, do you think that fits more in the charity or more in the businessy side of things?
I think at this point, it sounds to me, it's a lot like free software in academia is a lot like the 20% rule in a company.
That's a good call. So actually, why don't we decide to use that as our wrap up, and also a teaser for the next episode.
Ooh.
Ooh, teaser. You and I can now sign off, and we'll sign off officially, and we might just immediately record the next episode, but you won't get to see it for another week.
Or you're binge listening and you can just
That's right,
the next episode.
Yeah, that's true. All right, well, goodbye everybody. Hope you are having an excellent start of the new year. Happy 2019.
You've been listening to Libre Lounge. You can find and subscribe to us at librelounge.org. This podcast is released under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 4.0 International License. Our theme music is Bossa Nova by Joth, which is waived into the public domain under CC0, and which you can find on opengameart.org. If you'd like to support Chris Weber's work on this and other user freedom projects, you can donate at patreon.com/CWEBBER. Thanks for listening. See you next time.